Quick note, if you're a patron supporter, you already heard this episode on Friday. If you want next week's episode early, make sure to head on over to patreon.com/creepyshitpodcast and sign up. Link is available in the show notes. All right, let's get into it. All right, so if you remember, and I know this is a little while ago, but I put a thing up in my stories of this crazy story about this coffin that is literally sitting and teetering on top of a wall at Eddington Priory Church. Now, this coffin was meant to never touch sacred ground. So this became a thing. And I asked you guys what you thought and if you wanted a full episode on this. And you guys voted yes. So this is like a Creepy Crew community fan requested episode. So I am really excited about this because as I went down this rabbit hole, when I research, I just loved the story. It's creepy. It's British. And I love it. So we are going to get into this. So I'm going to go ahead. I'm going to share just a little bit of this with you. And I want you guys to imagine right now that you're walking through a quiet English village in Wiltshire, the kind of place where thatched cottages sit alongside ancient stone walls, where the air smells like rain and grass, like, seriously, I'm picturing like fog and a cup of coffee. This is beautiful already, I can tell. So you're taking a path that you've walked like 100 times before, okay? And maybe you grew up here. Maybe you're just passing through on one of those gray English afternoons. And then someone points up and says, hey, have you seen the witch's coffin? And you look at the perimeter wall of the old priory church, and there it is, a stone coffin perched on top of the wall, not, you know, tucked into a niche, not part of the architecture. This is literally sitting on top, okay, covered in ivy, slowly being consumed by time and nature. And for the record, I love pictures of like abandoned places that have gotten taken over by nature. Like they're beautiful. And so this is just there, this coffin, right? Balanced between the sacred ground below and empty air. Now, your first thought is probably like, what the fuck? Right? Your second thought is probably, okay, who's in there? And then your third thought is probably the one that makes our skin like prickle even on a warm day. Why is it there? Right? So, all right, everybody, I am super stoked. And this is definitely not like an elaborate folklore today. This is definitely real. As always, I'm all about the documented cases. And what's really interesting about this, too, is it's also pretty perplexing, even though there is documentation, because nobody really knows what the whole actual story is here. And that absence of truth, to me, that's what makes this genuinely creepy. So this is the story of the coffin at Eddington Priory Church, and it was the coffin that was never allowed to touch holy ground. So go grab your favorite bevy, get cozy, and let's do this. All right, let's go to Eddington. It is a small village in Wiltshire, England, about 6 kilometers east of Westbury, which, you know, I'm not good with like kilometers. I have no idea what that equates to in like miles or anything. I do not know. Population-wise, We're talking maybe like a few hundred people. It's the kind of place where everybody like knows everybody. It's kind of like a Cheers village, like if you remember Cheers, where the local pub is like your social center and where you might not even notice something weird until someone points it out to you. The village itself sits on the edge of Salisbury Plain. And if you know anything about that area, you know it's got like immense history just dripping from every stone. This is where actually King Alfred the Great defeated the Danes back, and this is crazy wicked, back in like 1878 AD. Like, damn, we're talking like the beginning of civilization. And this was actually the battle, if my memory serves right, it's the Battle of Ethandune. So we're talking like foundational English history here. So it's the kind of battle that changes the trajectory of a nation. That's interesting. And rather ironic. But we're not here for Alfred today. We're here for that damn coffin. So now, the Priory Church of St. Mary, St. Catherine, and All Saints dominates the village. Okay. It was consecrated in, oh, this is so gnarly. It was consecrated in 1361. I can't even fathom what life must have been like back then, because we're talking about a building that's been standing for over 660 years. That is some crazy fucking architecture. Like, seriously, it is grade one listed, which in British terms means it's architecturally and historically significant. Yeah, you bet your sweet Asper cream it is. Like, the church is this beautiful example of the transition between decorated and perpendicular, like Gothic architecture. And I've got pictures of this. I'm putting pictures up of this because you've got to see it. I will definitely have a good amount available to you guys because this is just, oh, like, I could just, like, I want to absorb all the pictures like into my very being and bloodstream, like not to be too morbid or creepy, because like, oh, I just want to see it. I would just stand in front of this place for hours, I swear. Now, when you see it, you'll understand also why it survived the dissolution of the monasteries, because it is magnificent. I cannot say this enough. Like, honestly, I'm really pumped up about this if you can't tell. Now, inside, there are medieval tombs, stained glass windows that have survived centuries, a plaster vaulted ceiling that makes you hold your breath. This is not some like forgotten ruin. This is an active parish church where people still worship to this day, where a famous music festival happens every August. Oh my gosh, the acoustics in there have got to sound so amazing. Oh my goodness. Okay. Now, also, tour groups come to, marvel at this medieval craftsmanship, which, like, absolutely. Now, on the perimeter wall, the boundary between the churchyard and the neighboring property, there's a stone coffin. And here's what we know for sure is that the coffin absolutely exists. Absolutely. There's pictures of it. We've posted it, as you know, you guys voted, all that good stuff. Now, it's definitely not an urban legend. It's not a trick of the light. Multiple people have photographed it, people have written about it, tried to investigate it. It's a stone coffin carved with some ornate decorations that are now being slowly overtaken by ivy. Now, I will tell you too, this is where, if you haven't listened to the past episode of Arched in Stone, or oh my gosh, I can't believe I just butchered that. Yeah, no, it is Arched in Stone. Okay, it is the book with Gina Black, and I thought that I said that backwards because sometimes I'm dyslexic, so I'm sorry. But this book, you need this book. Like, if you're a cemetery goer and you enjoy touring cemeteries, this is like your must-have guide to understand what some of the depictions are on tombstones and what they represent, and like all the different lore that goes into cemeteries. Like, the book is just seriously a masterpiece, if I do say so myself. And Gina, if you're listening, like, girl, I love you. I love your book so much. I can't tell you how many times I've referenced it. It is a must-have. But anyway, moving on. It sits on top of a wall, and this coffin is like not embedded in it. It's not part of the original construction. It's on top of it, like precariously balanced according to some of the description. Now, the wall itself marks the boundary of consecrated ground. So inside the wall and outside the wall, not holy. And this coffin is literally on the line. Now, even locals sometimes don't even know that it's actually there. Like, one person who photographed it mentioned it to villagers who had no idea that the coffin even existed, which is really interesting. So think about that. Like, something that strange, that visually striking, that, kind of wrong somehow, and people who live there just walk right past it without even seeing it. Like, that's kind of crazy, right? Like, I don't know. Like, I'm a little bit baffled by that, but this is also what gets me, the invisibility of it. The way, like, something so bizarre can just kind of fade into the background until someone actually asks, like, hey, what the hell is that? Right? So what's the story? Right? Like, who's inside this? What's happening? So, the most common explanation that you'll hear is this: it's the final resting place of an excommunicated monk, someone who was cast out of the church, denied the sacraments, spiritually severed from the body of Christ. Like, Jesus, like, no pun intended, but that seems awfully, like, severe, doesn't it? Spiritually severed? Like, good. I don't, that is just, that sounds so morbid to me. Like, I don't know. And because this monk was technically considered excommunicated, he couldn't be buried then in consecrated ground. Canon law was very, very, very fucking clear about this. Like, I kid you not. But here's where it also gets really interesting, because they didn't just like dump this monk anywhere or somewhere. They put him as close to the holy ground as possible without actually touching it. So on the wall, the boundary, the liminal space between salvation and damnation. So it's like this punishment and a mercy all at once. Now, some locals call it the witch's coffin, right? Which adds another layer of some serious dark folklore. And others suggest it might be an unbaptized child, because in medieval times, unbaptized babies were also denied burial in consecrated ground. Desperate mothers would place them as close to the churchyard as they could, hoping that proximity to holiness might count for something in the afterlife. Oh my gosh, that is just so. Oh, that just kind of made my heart sink a little bit thinking about that. I don't like it. Okay. There's this heartbreaking passage, and I'm going to be honest, I'm going to try really hard to say it right. Tess of the De Ubervie. I'm totally gonna butcher it. I'm so sorry. Oh, hang on. Just give me a verse. Yeah, okay. So I'm just gonna spell it for you. It's Tess of the D apostrophe U R B E R V I L L E. S, where Tess buries her unbaptized baby in a forgotten corner of the cemetery, as near to the church as she dares. This wasn't just Victorian fiction for this time. That was based on real practice, real grief, real desperation. But now, getting back to our Back to the Future day with the excommunicated monk theory, this is the one that actually sticks. And maybe because Eddington Priory has like a really, really rich like monastic history, and maybe because the idea of spiritual exile is more dramatically satisfying than any other explanations. And maybe because it just feels true. Okay, so here's the thing that drives me crazy, because we don't know. There is no documentation or church records and no historical account that says, and brother so-and-so was excommunicated for such and such, and his body was placed on the wall in accordance with medieval custom. So there's nothing. There's nothing saying that. And the mystery itself is actually what has become the story. Now, to understand why this coffin is so morally muffed up, you need to understand what burial meant in medieval England. And I mean, really understand it, not just in some abstract, oh, religion was important way. No, like in medieval Catholic worldview, your soul's journey after death depended heavily on what happened to your body. You needed last rites, the final confession, the anointing, the Vatican. You needed a funeral mass with specific prayers and rituals, and you absolutely, absolutely needed to be buried in consecrated ground. Now, consecrated ground wasn't just symbolically holy. It was spiritually transformed. When a bishop consecrated a cemetery, he walked in solemn procession around its boundaries, saying prayers to expel evil influences. The ground itself became sacred. Being buried there meant you were part of the communion of saints, that living parishioners would pray for your soul, that you had a shot at purgatory and eventually heaven. Being denied that, that was eternal damnation. Or at least that's what they taught you from the cradle at that time. The fear of dying outside of the church's grace was visceral, like not cool. So who got denied Christian burial? The list is longer and more specific than you might actually think, because obviously we've got pagans, Jews, heretics, schismatics, anyone who wasn't in communion with the church. But also, you have excommunicates. Excuse me. If you were excommunicated by name and died without absolution, no burial in holy ground. Your body desecrated the space. If someone secretly buried you in the churchyard anyway, oh, and this is so crazy. If they buried you in the churchyard anyway, the whole place had to be reconsecrated. Think about that. Like, damn. So your body would then be dug up and moved. Oh, I don't like that. You know that's how shit gets haunted. Spirits don't like being disturbed. I'm just saying. Now, the other part of this, who don't get like their rights and all that kind of stuff, right? Suicides, trigger alert. The logic was that suicide was self-murder, a mortal sin, and you couldn't repent because you were dead. So suicides were often buried at crossroads or just outside the churchyard walls. And then, of course, and it just makes me so sad because such innocent life, and it's so weird to even think that this was such a belief back then. It baffles me, the unbaptized infants. It's just, to me, it's just so incredibly cruel. And trigger alert on this, babies who died before baptism were considered tainted by original sin. No, they weren't. Like, seriously, oh, thank God we evolved from that, because I can't believe that that would even be a thought. That blows my mind. And I'm sorry if I'm overstepping, but babies are such innocent life. Like, how could you think that there was anything different? But those were the times. Those were the times, and it is what it was. And I don't know for sure, but I'm pretty sure that there are some. I don't know if that still exists in Catholicism or not. If anyone is Catholic, I am a recovering Catholic. I don't remember where if that was any more a thing or not. But anyway, unfortunately, those unbaptized babies would not be able to make it to heaven, but they weren't exactly damned either. They went into a limbo, according to some of the theology. Either way, there was no consecrated ground for them. Now, also, certain criminals, depending on the crime and the time period, you could be denied burial rites. And then lastly, people who violated their religious vows. So if priests decided to get married, if nuns would run away, if monks abandoned their monasteries, excommunication often followed that with it. But if it didn't get to that point yet, the loss of the burial rites would still exist. Does that make sense? Now, here's what really gets under my skin about this system. It wasn't just about the afterlife, it was about this life too. So if you were excommunicated, you couldn't receive the sacraments, you couldn't attend mass, other Christians weren't supposed to talk to you, do business with you, eat with you. You became socially dead before you were even physically dead. And the threat of dying excommunicated, that was a form of social control that doesn't really have a modern equivalent at this juncture. The closest I can think of is maybe being declared an enemy of the state in a totalitarian regime. You're cut off, you're othered, maybe into like a non-person. And the church knew this, and the sick thing is they used it. If a nobleman refused to pay taxes to the local priory, boom, excommunication. If a town rebelled against monastic authority, boom, the whole town gets excommunicated. It was spiritual, like terrorism, basically. Now, and the visual reminder of that power. Bodies buried outside the walls, bodies placed in liminal spaces, bodies that were denied rest. So there's this phrase that appears in medieval texts, and I am not kidding, this is not a joke. It's called asses burial. It comes from the book of Jeremiah, where the prophet says, quote, "He shall be buried with the burial of an ass." Wow. Drawn and cast forth beyond the gates of Jerusalem. Basically, thrown out like garbage, left for animals and the elements. No ceremony, no dignity, no prayers. Now, some medieval texts explicitly prescribe this for the worst offenders. One 10th century text says that those who violate church property or commit murder shall be cursed, anathematized, if I'm saying that right, and buried in the manner of gases in manure to the ground. In manure to the ground. Now, granted, if you are a criminal or someone bad, all right, I'm not against it. If you are in fact an ass, then yeah, you should be buried in ass. That's fine. Now, that's not just denial of burial. That's active like desecration of a corpse, like in my opinion. Now, I'm not saying that's what happened in Eddington, okay? So stay with me on that. That's not what I'm saying. The coffin on the wall is clearly not an ass's burial, but it exists on that same spectrum of punishment and exclusion. Someone cared enough to put the body in a coffin, but not enough to give it rest in holy ground. So the story is just, I feel like you could write a fiction book on this. You know what I mean? Like, maybe this is like newfound inspiration. Now, here's where it gets philosophically interesting, at least to me. The church taught that God was merciful, that repentance was always possible, that even the worst sinner could be saved if they turned back to God before death. But if you died excommunicated, even if you repented on your deathbed, if there was no priest there to absolve you, boo, you were fucked. Your eternal fate depended not just on the state of your soul, but on the logistics of absolution. And burial practices reflected that harsh theology. Your body became a teaching tool, a warning, a visible sign of what happens when you defy the church. That coffin on the wall, that's not just a burial site. It's actually a very powerful statement. Now, we'll get back to Eddington in a second, but first, we need to talk about the priory itself, because the church has definitely seen some shit, let me tell you. Now, Eddington Priory, like I said, was founded in 1351. Damn, saying it out loud each time, it's just like, holy shit, no pun intended. And it was founded by William Eddington, Bishop of Winchester. This guy was a big deal. He was a treasurer of England, one of the most powerful men in the kingdom, and he decided to establish a religious house in his home village. Now, originally, it was supposed to be like a college of chantry priests. Basically, guys whose job was to say masses for William's soul after he died. Medieval people were obsessed with getting prayers said for their souls in purgatory. The more prayers, the faster you got out. So rich people would endow chantries to guarantee they'd have prayers going up for them for years or for centuries. Now that's wild. That's wild. But in 1358, about 7 years later, the chantry became a house of the, and I think I'm going to say it right, the Bonhommes, which also translates to the good men. This was an Augustinian order, and Eddington was only the second house of this order in England. The first was Ashridge. After Eddington, there were no more. So just two houses. That's it. And the Bonhommes followed the rule of St. Augustine, and they wore gray robes. This detail is going to matter in just a little bit. So remember that. By all accounts, It was a very successful priory. At one point, there were like 18 brothers that lived there. They had money, they had land, and above all, they had influence. They maintained the monks' conduit and a spring, like a water system. All of that actually still exists today, which is impressive. And they were integrated into the life of the village. And then, okay, we're going to fast forward here pretty quick. 1450 happened and something really terrible happened. Okay, so June 29th, 1450, England is in serious chaos. Jack Cade's rebellion is tearing through the South. This was a popular uprising against King Henry VII, or I'm sorry, VI, weak government, military failures, and corrupt advisors. Interesting. Mobs were roaming the countryside, looking for representatives of the regime to punish. Interesting. Ironic. Okay. William, who was, and I think you say it Ascoff. Okay. Bishop of Salisbury was one of those targets. He was King Henry's personal confessor, which made him a symbol of everything people hated about the government. Okay. So he was also apparently not well liked in his own diocese. He'd been restricting trading rights in Salisbury, extracting money, and throwing his weight around. When the rebellion broke out, William ran. He fled Salisbury and sought sanctuary at Edington Priory Church. Now, sanctuary was supposed to be inviolable, right? If you made it inside the church, you were under God's protection. Nobody could touch you. But on June 29th, an angry mob, including a lot of the men from Salisbury, reportedly led by a beer brewer, attacked him down. They found him during Mass. Now let that sink in. He was celebrating Mass at the high altar, performing the holiest sacrament of the church, the reenactment of Christ's sacrifice, surrounded by prayers and incense and the supposed protection of sacred space. They dragged his ass out of there. They took him to the top of Edington Hill, just outside the village. Now, remember, this is 1450, so you can imagine what the punishment was. And they stoned him to death. Yeah. I don't care, like, it's just crazy, like, the punishments and the things that happened back in those days. It's just wild to me. And so creepy. Like, that's just creepy. I don't like it. Now, think about the symbolism here. You have a bishop, a representative of God's authority on earth, dragged from the altar during the most sacred moment and was murdered by a mob. In the medieval worldview, this was almost unthinkable. It was sacrilege on a cosmic scale, but it happened. And you know what? The perpetrators weren't immediately struck down by divine wrath. The rebellion continued. People got on with their lives. Later, there was supposedly a chapel built at the site of the murder. Like Hermitage, if I'm Hermitage, I'm not sure if I'm saying that right, where people could pray for Askoff's soul, but that's now gone. There is no trace of it. Like, nothing remains. It's just land now, like, in today's, I don't know what the word is that I'm looking for, but you get my point. So what does remain is the memory of violence at this supposedly peaceful priory church, and the memory that sanctuary wasn't always protection. The mobs don't respect consecrated ground when they're angry enough. And I can't help but wonder, does that murder have anything to do with the coffin on the wall? That's my thought. Now, fast forward about, 90 years, we'll say. 1539, Henry VIII is systematically destroying the monasteries, confiscating their wealth, kicking out monks and nuns, redistributing property to his supporters. Eddington Priory was peacefully dissolved. The last provost was Paul Bush, and he got a pension. He went on to become Bishop of Bristol. The brothers were given pensions too. It was all very civilized, relatively speaking. Okay. Now, the priory buildings were demolished or they were repurposed. Fish ponds that had belonged to the monastery were filled in. Oh, that's kind of a bummer. The land was parceled out. The church survived, but it was also the parish church. So it served the villagers and not just the monks. So it was allowed to continue. But the monastic community was totally gone. Now, the Bonhomes are rare in specific order. They vanished, like poof, just gone from England. And remember, there were only two houses and now there were none. So what happened to the bodies of the brothers who died over those 180 some years, right? Most are probably buried in and around the church, but what about the brother who was excommunicated? What about the one who violated his vows and committed an unforgivable sin? Did they stick his coffin on the wall as a warning? A reminder that even in a holy community, spiritual exile was possible? Or is the coffin older than the priory itself? Could it date back to the earlier church, the one the nuns of Romsey Abbey built before William Eddington ever showed up? Again, we don't know. Isn't that just so fucking maddening? I'm sorry, you guys. I don't mean, like, seriously, if you're throwing your headphones right now, I'm sorry. So let's talk about why lack of documentation bothers me so much on this one. Like, there is some which helps me to understand, like, the building of the church, how things happened. Like, all of that documentation was very valuable to this story. But there's a lot of it that is still missing, too. And Eddington Priory Church is well-maintained, well-documented. Like I said, it's historically significant. There are books about it. There's been academic papers, tourism websites. The church has its own website as well with detailed history. And that helped me a lot in this, in digging into this. And there's a musical festival there every year that attracts people from all over the world. And yet, when it comes to the coffin on the wall, there's nothing. In my opinion, I think they know, but they don't share it for whatever reason. Like, and maybe it's just to build up the hype on it. And like, well, now this is kind of fun. And, you know, people draw their own conclusions. Maybe it was something that was even requested. I don't know. Like, there's so many possibilities on this coffin. Like, and I just, like, I swirl on this, seriously. Like, my hands are placed on top of my head because I'm literally thinking right now about all the different things. Now, one photographer who documented it in 2008 wrote, "Someone told me it was the last resting place of a monk who had been excommunicated and therefore not allowed to be buried within the church. I would love to find out more about it, but cannot find any reference to it on any website. Spoke to a few locals who did not even know it existed, so they weren't much help either." That was almost 20 years ago, you guys, in an age of the internet, and still nothing. Why? Why, I ask you, why? So here are my theories, and I'm just spitballing here. And I would love to hear from you on what you guys think because I love having these discussions with you. Seriously, Creepy Crew community, you guys are so much fun to go down the rabbit hole with when we start thinking about theories. So, theory one, it's embarrassing. Maybe the church doesn't want to draw attention to burial practices that seem cruel by modern standards, putting somebody's body on a wall because they died outside of the church's grace. That's not exactly a feel-good story. Like, tourism boards don't want to lead with, "Come see where we punish the dead," right? Like, that's just not really going to sell. So, theory two, the records were lost. Now, this is actually pretty plausible. The dissolution of the monasteries involved the destruction or scattering of the monastic archives. A lot of medieval documents just didn't survive. And maybe the explanation for the coffin was in a ledger or chronicle that got burned or stolen or repurposed for, unfortunately, probably scrap paper. Now, theory three, it was always meant to be anonymous. Maybe the point was that we wouldn't know who it was. The identity doesn't matter. What matters is the symbol. Like, here lies someone who died outside God's grace. Let that be a warning to you. Damn, that's harsh. Then you've got theory four. It's not actually that old. Maybe the coffin was placed there later, 19th century, maybe. And there was a romantic fascination with medieval things. Maybe it's literally just a piece of architectural salvage that someone thought would look dramatic on the wall. I don't really buy that theory for the record. I'm just saying. The stone looks genuinely old, and the oral tradition about it seems to go back further than the Victorian era. But I'm not totally going to rule that out entirely. Okay, and then theory five. Like I was saying, someone knows and they ain't talking. This is my paranoid theory. Maybe there are church records. Maybe the local historical society knows. Maybe the Illuminati knows. I don't know. But maybe family who owns the property next to the church wall knows. But for whatever reason, whether that be like privacy, respect, perhaps maybe even superstition, they're keeping quiet. Here's the thing, though. The mystery itself has so much power because, like I said, like my head has spun on this. If you knew for sure that it was Brother Thomas who was excommunicated in 1423 for stealing from the poor box, or Sister Marjorie who broke her vows of chastity, or some random guy named John who happened to die in the wrong place at the wrong time, if we knew that for sure, that would probably make the story smaller and contained and explainable and also kind of boring. But because we don't know, the coffin becomes a repository of all our anxieties about death and judgment and spiritual exile, does it not? It becomes a blank slate onto which we can project our fears. So who's in there? Could it be me if I lived in those times? Could it be someone I love, someone who made one mistake and paid for it eternally? The coffin asks the question, what does it mean to be unforgivable? Ew. I don't like that. Ew. Okay. Now, we don't have excommunication in quite the same way anymore. And honestly, thank goodness for that. At least not in most denominations. The Catholic Church still technically excommunicates people, but it's really rare. And it doesn't come with the same social death sentence. But we do have other forms of exile, don't we? Cancel culture is the obvious parallel. Someone does or says something wrong and they're cast out of their community. They become untouchable. Their name becomes a warning. And I think of, like, and this is very modern day exile, but the first person I thought of when I said that was the Phillies Karen story. That woman got completely exiled, did she not? Like, socially, she lost her job, all of those things. Or, okay, think about criminal records. People who serve their time but can never truly re-enter society because their past follows them everywhere. They're not in prison anymore, but they're not exactly free either. They exist in a liminal space, like a coffin on a wall, right? Or think about like refugees and stateless people, literally denied burial rights in their home countries, literally existing between borders, neither here nor there. The coffin on the wall is medieval, but the concept of spiritual and social exile, that's actually really timeless. Now, I'm not going to pretend to be neutral here on this, because I do think there are things, you know, as always, that we can never fully explain, and things that defy rationalist explanations. But I believe that something about that coffin is definitely just wrong. And not because I believe in ghosts or like going into all of that, but because symbols definitely have power. Liminal spaces have power. Exile and punishment and like collective forgetting. These things leave marks on the world, and that coffin has been there for centuries, balanced on the edge between holy and profane, slowly being overtaken by ivy, slowly fading from memory, and the fact that we don't know the whole story. That makes it worse, not better. Like, because who's ever in there, like if it's a criminal, a witch, a monk, they've been forgotten twice. Once when they were denied proper burial, and again when their story was lost to time. That's haunting in a way that ghost stories aren't. That's the kind of creepy shit that is gonna stay with you. And I believe in this because I've studied enough reincarnation cases. I've been through enough documented, like, paranormal, like, extravaganzas, if you will, to know that consciousness does not just disappear, right? Like, we're all energy. And that trauma is going to leave an imprint. And injustice will do its best to echo. And if there's anywhere those echoes would linger, it's in a place like this. A coffin that's neither buried nor exposed. A body that's neither blessed nor cursed. A person who's neither remembered nor forgotten. That's liminal space at its most literal. So, and liminal spaces, dude, that's where weird shit happens, does it not? So, we know there's a stone coffin, and we know the church itself has a violent, complicated history from its foundation. And we know that the medieval burial practices were harsh and unforgiving, and that the church wielded immense power over not just people's lives, but their afterlives as well. So this mystery makes me think about all other, like, forgotten, passed away souls, the ones who didn't get proper burials, who were cast out or abandoned or erased, the unmarked graves, the mass graves. Like the bodies buried at sea or burned or left in the wilderness. History likes to remember the great and powerful, the kings and bishops and warriors. But what about everyone else? What about all the others that are out there? What about the people who died on the wrong side of the wall? The coffin at Ennington is, in some ways, almost like a memorial of all of them, a reminder that not everyone gets to rest in peace. So, if you ever are in Wiltshire, please go see it. Like, really, go to Ennington, walk the path around the Priory Church, look up at that wall. And when you see it, if you see it, because apparently a lot of people tend to walk right past it without noticing, just take a moment. Think about whoever could possibly be in there. Think about the choices they made or the circumstances they faced that led that final resting place. And, you know, if you are of a religious heart, maybe say a prayer for them or say a nice, kind word or just acknowledge them because whoever they were, they're still there. They're still suspended between earth and heaven and still waiting for someone to remember their name. Now, here's my final thoughts. Okay. The coffin that cannot touch holy ground. It's definitely one crazy heck of a story. And the fact that we can't fully explain it, that we can't tie it up neatly. And with documentation and dates and names, that doesn't make it any less real. If anything, it makes it a whole lot more haunting, in my opinion, because sometimes the scariest stories are the ones that end with, and nobody knows what happened next. Yeah. So, seriously, that's all I've got on this. So I would love, love, love to hear your thoughts on this episode. You can definitely DM me over on Instagram at creepy_shit_podcast. You could also send me an email if you would like to. And if you have any episodes that you want to request, or if there's a fun fact that I missed about this, please send it over to me. I always love finding out more. And you can send that to creepyshitpodcastofficial@gmail.com. And if you do have just an extra little moment, I would so love and appreciate a 5-star review. And if you got 120 seconds, please make a note of why you love the podcast so much. And I appreciate you being here. So until next time, remember, sometimes the creepiest shit is also the truest. Okay, bye.